and welcome to a new series, The Celtic Saints of Britain. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and I am very pleased to say that I have an old co-host back with me today, an old friend that we haven't had on Radio Aryan for quite a while and that lots of people have been asking after, and that is, of course, Florian Geyer. Florian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing just grand, Sven. It's really always a pleasure to be back on doing these wonderful broadcast with you. I think especially the topic and content we have today and for our next couple of episodes will be very fruitful.
Definitely. This is a subject that I really wanted to get into. And really, it first came up in conversation with you on Skype a while back, I think. I think you were studying one of these Celtic saints, or it was one of their feast days. May have been St. Chad mm-hmm. or St. Cuthbert. Do you remember which one it was?
I think it was on the occasion of St. Cuthbert's day. And we just sort of started to get into it on the history of some of these early English and Celtic saints, you know, from the British Isles, and their glorious history and the deep inculcation of Christianity in the British Isles generally. And it has really a florescent history that is much ignored, I think, by lots of people who are of that particular descent, and especially today, many people, you know, the sorry state of Christianity, many people, as we know, are not so fond of it and are not interested in delving in or giving exposure to the glories of its past or to the great lofty state which it had obtained in the British Isles in the 6th to 8th centuries AD, before it unfortunately began its long descend into its current form. So that is the purpose of our little broadcast here today, I think, is to investigate and delve into some of the lives of these different Anglo and Celtic saints and the history of the Church in Britain.
It definitely is a really glorious history that Christianity has within Britain. And I think particularly at the time I was thinking, you know, it's so strange that we get British nationalists that look to paganism and think that paganism is somehow British. And it wasn't British. Paganism was something that was brought over by the Anglo-Saxons, who were foreign at the time, and it only lasted for 150 years. The tradition of Odinism and Wotan and Freya and all these Nordic gods, it's not a British tradition. That is a foreign tradition. It lasted for 150 years, as I say, when the Saxons came over, and then it was gone again. And what a lot of these people don't realise is that before then, Britain was Christian, and had been Christian for quite some time. And these saints, these Celtic saints, they were real heroes, real heroic types that we're going to get into here. They had fantastic lives. They fought in battles. They fought in wars. They worked miracles. They were miracle workers. Their relics afterwards healed people. And they're just really amazing people with fantastic stories behind them. And when you think of the way that people love the sword and sorcery epics today, you know, you just think, well, why don't you go back and read some of the lives of some of these saints? You got real life histories there with real life fantastic events that our people used to believe in, that they said all this happened. This really happened. And they believed it. It's really interesting stuff. But I think what we should really start with is just sort of setting the scene of what Britain was like and who the Celts really were, because E. Michael Jones has recently been saying that Europe was just barbarians. They didn't really have a civilization. And there is a certain amount of truth to that. The Germanic tribes didn't come here till later on, and they did arrive as mercenaries and fighters. They fought against Rome. But there was technically proficient people in Europe, in Northern Europe, in Britain at that time, so technically proficient that they were able to defeat Julius Caesar in 55 BC. They may not have had a civilization, they may not have had cities, but that was because they were mainly tin miners, and they were mining this tin so that they could trade it, and copper as well, so they could trade it back to the centers of civilization, which was in the Middle East. So we can look at this history. We can probably start around about 3000 BC. We start seeing dolmens and standing stones, stone circles, and we see them in the Middle East, and they spread out into Europe just along the coast, and they also spread out into places like Korea, but much later on in Korea, about 1500 BC. About 3000 BC, you start seeing them along the coasts of Europe, and that's because this is where the really sort of tough colonists from the civilizations in the Fertile Crescent, they were heading over here to do that. And if you're going to build cities, if you're going to have civilizations, you have to have agricultural sustainability. You have to have a system of getting the food in from the fields to the cities to build these cities and to have these philosophers. And to a certain extent, you have to have this agricultural sustainability just to put up dolmens and standing stones and stone circles. So that tells us that they had a certain amount of intelligence. Another thing it tells us is that they were good seafarers. And the history of shipping and the history of boats is also going to fit in with this series, because the reason why these Celtic saints were able to convert people in Brittany and elsewhere in Europe is because they were expert seafarers as well. So the history of the boats, I mean, that really started in Egypt. They had reed boats, and these reed boats, they got as far as Sri Lanka and the Ganges, which is quite a feat when you imagine what a reed boat is. It's not particularly sturdy. And then around about 3000 BC, about the time of these dolmens and standing stones, they were forced to keep up with the marine technology from Lebanon. And in Lebanon, they had cedar boats. So Egypt started making its boats out of cedar as well. And then 2000 BC, you get the Minoans. And they're the first recorded people as having reached all the way to Britain by sea. And they were trading for copper and tin with the people that were on Britain, who were obviously colonists from earlier. And that was when the copper and tin was too expensive in Cyprus. And then you end up with the Phoenicians. And the Phoenicians making their way over to Britain as well. They're getting copper and tin from Britain in trade. And then, of course, there's the Greek myth that says that Phoenix gave birth to Europa. So there's this bit of history that the ancients used to believe that the British people came from Phoenicia. And then we get records 12,000 BC. We get Odysseus navigating by the stars. 1000 BC, we've actually got the remains of Britain's oldest boat. So 3000 years old, this boat has been found, and it was made with the Egyptian method. Timber planking, pegs, joints, rope lashings. That's actually found in North Ferriby in Yorkshire. So this shows us that we had the same technology that they had in Egypt, basically, and in the Fertile Crescent, just outside of Britain. 500 BC, you get a chap called Himilco, who is a Carthaginian seafarer. And he said that it takes 4 months to get to Britain from the Straits of Gibraltar. And he said the sea was blocked with weed, there's no wind, and there's a perpetual fog. And I guess the perpetual fog must have lifted at night so that they could navigate by the stars, because that couldn't have been the only way that they did it. Also around 500 BC, we've dated this chap called Clonny Claven Man. He was 5'2", and this is a body that they found in Britain. And he had pine resin hair gel, which was from Loire in South France. This was a very expensive substance that he had. It shows that these people took care of themselves. And this is a substance that we use today, is hair gel. And we also find another man from that time, Old Croghan Man, and he was 6'6", and apparently he had well-manicured fingernails, and both of them died from violent deaths. They say it was ritual deaths. I have a suspicion that they may have been executed for sodomy. Well-manicured fingernails, you know, hair gel, hairspray. That may not be the case, but we do know that is something that they did. And so we know that they were trading at that time. They were certainly civilized people, even if they may not have had a civilization. 330 BC, you get a chap called Pytheas, and he navigates around the whole of Britain. He's a Greek person, and he records that he sees these leather coracles off the coast of Cornwall. And he sees them taking tin ingots out to Michael's Mount, and there are Phoenician ships there that are loading up this tin, and they're taking them back. And these people, these were the Celts. They never were called Celts, but when they started doing archaeology in the 16th century, the starting of archaeology, they basically labelled the languages that were spoken in Ireland, Wales, and Scotland as being Celtic, and the languages that were spoken in Gaul as being Celtic. So it was basically a sort of shared language. There were two different types of it. Irish, Manx and Pictish is one type, and Welsh, Breton and Cornish is this other type of Celt. So these were the Celts. They were trading with the civilization in the Middle East, as I was saying, by the time they get to 400 BC, they've got roads. They had a road from Dover to Holyhead. According to Julius Caesar, there were 40 university towns here. There were 60,000 students, and it would take them 20 years of study to actually become a Druid. And all the aristocracy and the nobles from Gaul would actually come over to Britain to study. And in 55 BC, Caesar tried to make war against Britain, and he was defeated. And not a lot of British people really know that, but we sent him packing with his tail between his legs back to Gaul. And there he stayed. And then, of course, you get the life of Jesus, you get the crucifixion. And then in 38 AD, that's when we're first told that Joseph of Arimathea first came to Britain and put up the first church at Glastonbury. And we hear about that from various later sources in the church. But we also have Gildas. He was writing in 560 AD, and he said that Christianity came to Britain in the time of Tiberius Caesar, which puts it at 38 AD. And then we have Maelgwyn of Llandaff writing in 450 AD, and this is actually a charter of land, and it's talking about the church that Joseph of Arimathea founded, and it actually tells you the place of his burial there. So we've got quite solid evidence that Joseph of Arimathea came over here. He came over here, he was granted this land. Obviously, he then tried to convert people, and we're told in the Welsh histories that he actually managed to convert this king that was called Caradoc, or Caractacus, who is also famous for actually being defeated by the Romans, because in 43 AD, Emperor Claudius comes back to war against Britain, and Caractacus is sold out by this female, Caris Mandua, by her treachery. He's taken to Rome, and he says, for the first time ever, why don't you have mercy on somebody? And then instead of just going down in history as Rome the Terrible, you will also go down in history as Rome the Merciful. So Rome has mercy on him, and they put him under house arrest. And his father's there as well. This hostage, Bran, is the name of his father. And Bran is recorded as being a Christian. So we don't know whether Caradoc was, but we do know that his father was. His father had been converted by somebody. And then we're told that they lived in the Palatium Britannicum, which then became the Hospitium Pudentiana, which was the first church, basically, at Rome. It was the house of the British king. In 56 AD, King Bran returns from Rome, and apparently he has Saint Aristobulus with him, which is probably a saint that you're aware of there, Florian, I would have thought. Saint Aristobulus.
Yeah, you know? Saint Aristobulus. He's one of the 70 disciples.
Yeah, so he's called Arvarui in Welsh. So we've got records of him coming over and him being sort of the first saint in Britain, I think. Then you've got Justin Martyr and Irenaeus. They're writing in the first century, they say, or about 101 AD, I think. And they say that there are Christians in every land that's known to the Romans. In 167 AD, we have King Lucius in Britain, and he becomes a Christian, and the whole British nation becomes Christian. And we actually learn later on from Bede, after one of these church synods, that in order to make any changes to religion, the British people have to go back and have a unanimous vote from all the British people to make any changes in religion. So the fact that King Lucius and all the British people became Christian at that point, that shows you it couldn't have been forced upon them. The only way it could have happened is if they'd sat down and looked at what Christianity was and decided that that was preferable to following the Druids. And the Druids also are recorded as becoming bishops at the time. And in 179 AD, we get the first church in London, which is called St. Peter's. 190 AD, we have Tertullian. He says Christianity is in all the parts of Britain that the Romans fear to go to, where they fear to tread. 210 AD, we have Origen. He says the power of God our Saviour is even with them in Britain, who are separated from our world, separated from the Roman world. 320 AD, Eusebius says some of the apostles passed over the ocean to the British Isles, because there are also rumours that Peter and Paul actually came over here. There are a lot of rumours that St. Paul came over here, but I don't think there is as much evidence as there is for Joseph of Arimathea. 350 AD, St. Athanasius testifies to the fidelity of the Britons to the purity of the faith, which shows you that it wasn't Gnosticism or anything like that the Christians were following. It was exactly the same as it was in the East. And then in 400 AD, St. John Chrysostom, he says the faith is the same in Britain They just speak a different language. So we have this rich history of Christianity and a rich history of actually being an important part of Europe. When you think that all the aristocracy would come over from Gaul to Britain to be trained and go back again. So we had communication with the Middle East. We had communication with Rome. We had a maritime system, and the British people were the first to actually proclaim themselves Christian. And that was, I think it was 150 years before Rome actually legalized Christianity. And of course, that was down to King Constantine, who was a British king, and I've gone into that before, so I won't go into that now. I don't know if you want to comment on any of that before we move into some of these saints.
Well, sure. Absolutely. I mean, even what you just presented here, this could be enough for a couple of episodes. And it's really, really important. I was just reflecting to someone else the other day that one of the greatest deficits, I think, in any sort of contemporary Christianity is that people are very ignorant of the early history of Christianity, no matter what part of the world it may be in. And it really is for shame, because in our contemporary society, we have all of the access to this ancient information, all of this ancient documentary evidence, just for free at our fingertips. It's in English for the most part. And so this is the thing, even with these early apologists, you know, 100 AD, you can read St. Justin Martyr, the philosopher, whose feast day was yesterday, you know, giving his discourses on in defense of the Christian faith. And so the whole Greco-Roman Mediterranean culture, of which Britain was its north or western extremity and had been integrated into for some time, as we saw with the Phoenician trade networks in 1000 BC, was as we have seen demonstrated, very early exposed to Christianity from a few short years after the death of Christ, which is not unusual. I mean, you know, you have mystery religions, Mithraism, and all of these kind of things show up in London because it's an integral part of the Mediterranean trade network. And it's very easy, relatively speaking, to go from Palestine to Britain by ancient standards. And so there's no surprise here that, of course, Britain as a part of an integral part of the Roman Empire would be exposed to Christianity as the apostles began to spread. And this is mentionable because when Christ gives the Great Commission to the apostles and he says to go to make disciples unto the ends of the earth, in the ancient times, you know, the ends of the earth, this was not just a poetic expression. There was a sort of sense that there are these kind of, you know, cardinal points of the earth, not in a flat earth sort of sense, but that there are these like,
limits, the known world.
Poles, yes, right, exactly. Right. If you think of the Roman Empire as the world and so forth. And so, you know, Britain is one of these, you know, ends of the earth. And so it's conceivable, and I would say, you know, probable that you would have very, very early, at least sporadic and defrayed evangelization of the British islands and the British people by the apostles or some of the 70 disciples, right? Abrus de Bulos is very well known as the first disciple of Christ to be in London, either him or Joseph of Arimathea, depending on the sources. You know, and so, and he was one of the 70 disciples. So, and I think that it's also important just to comment as well, culturally speaking, is that the Celtic civilizations which inhabited, but Gaul, but especially Britain, because they weren't disrupted by the Germanic invasions, had a very, very highly developed metallurgical understanding. Their metalworking skills were some of the best in the world, basically between them and in the Ganges Valley, not the Ganges Valley, the Indus River Valley in India. And so there was lots of, especially early types of steel were exported into Rome. Or high quality iron. And it was difficult in Rome. It was quite a highly valued commodity. And it's one of the things you even see that the tradition of sword making among the Celtic peoples is richer than in Rome because they have a steadier access to high quality iron and later steel, which is why Rome tends to favor shorter weapons. So all of these things kind of play together. It's just to say that Rome and Britain, as it existed in the classical era when it was first converted to Christianity and exposed to it, you know, was quite a developed civilization of its own, although it was, of course, naturally at the hinterlands. And after the disruption of Western Roman political authority, you know, 200 years later, 300 years later, we see that it begins to rapidly develop its own indigenous culture and infrastructure, both religiously, politically, militarily, civilizationally, you know, and it will come to be affected by all of the great civilizational shifts that we read about that have affected Europe since the fall of the Western Roman state and continue to affect us to this day. So, and all of these things are, it's very important to make this in contradistinction to even a place like Western Germany, just across the Rhine, which was most certainly not part of the civilized world. It was very, it was much more of a borderland, much more of a fringe empire. And I think that, you know, when we're trying to deal with the Christianity, is that in many senses, Christianity became bound up with and embodied within, especially in the Mediterranean environment, the Roman Empire and Romanism and the idea of this Roman sort of uber civilization. Oh, and all of these, this context is necessary to express that Britain was an integral part of this Roman civilization. And so it received its own unique, but indelibly Roman form of Christianity, which is characteristically traditional, as we shall see.
And I think I just point out there as well, I mean, when just after Christ's crucifixion and resurrection, the Judeans were all expelled, and Christians as well were persecuted. And the one place where Christians could go where they weren't actually illegal would have been Britain, because Druidry and Christianity were banned throughout the Roman Empire, but they still continued in Britain right up until what the time was it? I've lost my little bit on here. I think it was about 151 AD when the Romans actually came over the second time, and then they did actually make a treaty with Britain. So from 38 AD to 51 AD, Britain would have been a refuge for Christians, rather than going to Germany, which was, you know, a bit too rough and tumble. It's quite conceivable that Britain is somewhere that they would have headed for. So Joseph of Arimathea, if he was a refugee, this is the place that he would have that he would have actually headed to. And then you ended up with, because it was part of the Roman Empire, you ended up with a persecution under Diocletian, and there was, I forget how many, I think it might have been 2,000 marches. There's actually a place called St. Albans in Cornwall that's named after one of these famous marches after Diocletian. And it was after Diocletian fell that you got King Constantine the Great, who then became the Emperor Constantine and legalized Christianity in Rome. And then eventually you had the Romans leaving Britain, and I think right about this time as well, all the strong men from Britain and all the warriors, they actually followed one of their kings off into Europe for a big battle, leaving Britain without anybody to defend it, because this leader was so charismatic, they followed him off into Europe. And then also at the same time, you had a comet that's recorded as hitting, and there was a lot of plague, so there were a lot of people dying. So then when you get to the time of the Saxons coming over in about 449 AD, this is why it was so easy for them to just take over. And this is why the Britons couldn't defend themselves against the Picts, because, you know, there's a bit of a disparity here. You think, well, the Britons were able to defeat Rome at first in 55 BC. They were that strong, and they had Christianity, and they had this, you know, this civilized center when Rome was here. So how come these Picts that had always been there, how come they found it so easy to just, you know, just maraud across the country, and the Britons had to call across to the Saxons for help? And that was the reason for it, because all the best fighters had left Britain, and you had this comet and this plague as well. And also, I mean, when you were bringing up there about how it's all tied in with Roman Christianity, I mean, the first place that really took off as part of Christendom was, I've momentarily forgotten his name, Charles Martel's father, Charlemagne, that's it. It was Charlemagne's, mm-hmm. Charlemagne's Christian fiefdom that he had there. And that was who Alfred the Great really looked up to. So you didn't actually have something like Charlemagne had, but you had something different here in Britain. And actually, when they sent Augustine over to convert the Anglo-Saxons, he really didn't have that much success. He didn't really get that much further than Kent. And it was actually the Britons and the Celts, it was the Welsh and the Irish that sort of buried the hatchet and thought, well, look, these are our brothers here and we need to convert them. Yes, they've driven us out of the land there in southern England, but really we should be going over there and converting them and bringing them to Christ. And that's who the majority of these Celtic saints are that we're going to be talking about. I mean, they loved their race. They really did love their race because there was no other reason why they would do that. They wanted to bring this message of Christianity to these people that they'd just been fighting against. And rather than leave it up to emissaries from Rome, which they did have fallings out with, they went and did it themselves, which I think is a very noble task that they actually took upon themselves. And they were very successful with it, because Augustine came over in 597. And it's all recorded that he knew that there was a British church here already, and they wanted to know why the British church hadn't been trying to convert these Anglo-Saxons. And that was why, because they'd been making war against them and driven them out of half the country. So we'll get into some of that later on in the series when the Welsh actually go there to convert the Saxons there. Augustine as well. I don't think he was, you know, he really wasn't that nice a chap. He really wasn't very humble. He wanted to meet the Britons, and the Britons said, "Well, should we pay this man our respects? Should we do what he says?" And there was a wise hermit by the roadside, and he said, "Well, when you go and see him, if he stands up to greet you, then do everything that he says because he's humble. If he doesn't stand up to greet you and sees himself as being above you, then just ignore what he says." And Augustine didn't stand up to greet them. So the British church thought, well, he's a bit too stuffy, and why should we be paying honours to Rome anyway when we were Christian before them for 200 years? And this Augustine actually cursed them. And later on, we hear about the university at Bangor, which was filled with thousands of priests and a monastery, and they were writing scriptures and everything. And one of these Anglo-Saxon pagan warriors slaughtered thousands of these priests. They were unarmed priests that were just walking barefoot on the road to pray for the success of their people in having a battle against the Saxon group. And the Saxons slaughtered them all. It was a horrific slaughter that was, you know, it stuck in the British people's memory for a long time. And yet they still buried the hatchet, as it were, and offered the hand of peace to these Anglo-Saxons and succeeded. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Florian. I think we should get into St. Sampson of Dol tomorrow. I think we've covered the basics here.
Well, I think that is a very good introduction, giving people a lot of context. I think every one of the details that we've already listed, we can get much deeper into in future episodes. So I think that's the thing to do.
Okay. We'll be back tomorrow with St. Sampson of Dol. Thank you very much for listening. God bless and hail victory.